From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
In October, the FCC will make it possible for all Americans to apply for non-commercial full-power radio stations across the country. This is probably going to be the last time in the foreseeable future for Americans to apply for these licenses, so now is the time to act.
Radio for the people. As Rupert Murdoch expands his media empire, we look at how the Federal Communications Commission is preparing to give nonprofit community groups a once-in-a-generation opportunity to start their own full-power FM radio stations. Then the Canadian government has confirmed the CIA played a role in the rendition of Canadian citizen Maher Arar. We'll speak to CBC broadcaster Avi Lewis. And finally, we look back at the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki 62 years ago this week. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Vice President Dick Cheney's reportedly urging President Bush to directly confront Iran by launching airstrikes at suspected Iranian training camps inside Iraq run by the Quds Force, a special unit of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. According to the McClatchy newspapers, Cheney made the proposal several weeks ago, but the idea was opposed by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. On Thursday, President Bush warned Iran that it would face consequences if they continue to arm and train insurgents in Iraq.
One of the main reasons that I asked Ambassador Crocker to meet with Iranians inside Iraq was to send the message that there will be consequences for people transporting, delivering EFPs, highly sophisticated IEDs that kill Americans in Iraq. Prime Minister Maliki is visiting in Tehran today. His message, I'm confident, will be stabilize, don't destabilize, and the sending of weapons into the Iraq is a destabilizing factor.
President Bush also directly warned Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki about his close ties to Iran. Maliki is currently on a three-day trip to Tehran, where he has met with the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and other top Iranian officials. According to Iran's state-run news agency, Maliki has thanked Iran for its, quote, positive and constructive work in providing security and fighting terrorism in Iraq. At Thursday's news conference, President Bush was asked about Maliki's ties to Iran.
Is he trying to get Iran to play a more constructive role? I presume he is. That's what my question is. What my message to him is that when we catch you playing a non-constructive role, there'll be a price to pay.
After the news conference, the White House attempted to backtrack from Bush's statement that al-Maliki would have to pay a price for his ties to Iran. A spokesperson from the National Security Council claimed Bush's remark was directed at Iran. Also Thursday, President Bush appeared to call on the Iranian people to change their government.
My message to the Iranian people is you can do better than this current government. You don't have to be isolated. You don't have to be in a position where you can't realize your full economic potential. And the United States of America will continue to work with our friends and allies in the Security Council and elsewhere to put you in a position to deny you your rightful place in the world, not because of our intention, because of your government's intention.
The McClatchy newspapers also report that concern is growing in Baghdad over the Bush administration's stance on Iran. One Iraqi official said, quote, we don't want Iraq to become a zone of conflict between Iran and the U.S. In other news on Iraq, the U.S. military has dropped all charges against two Marines connected to the shooting deaths of 24 Iraqi civilians in Haditha. Lance Corporal Justin Sharat had been charged with three counts of premeditated murder, and Captain Randy Stone with dereliction of duty for failing to properly report the civilian deaths. Five Marines still face charges for shooting dead two dozen unarmed men, women, and children in Haditha on November 19, 2005. The New York Times is reporting Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf was on the brink of declaring a state of emergency this week, but backed away after a gathering storm of media, political, and diplomatic pressure. Part of the pressure came from the Bush administration. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice called General Musharraf at about 2 a.m. on Thursday and exhorted him not to declare emergency rule. Under emergency rule, Musharraf would have been able to restrict freedom of movement and assembly, suspend parliament, and curtail the activities of the courts. Pakistani opposition leader and former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto said emergency rule would have been a major setback.
We are all moving towards democracy, and General Musharraf has said he wants to take the country towards democracy. So I thought the imposition of emergency would be a very retrograde step and take us further away from the goal of the democratization of Pakistan. I thought it would also lead to internal instability because the political parties and the legal community were bound to protest the imposition of emergency. But I'm very relieved to find today that those reports were speculative, untrue, and that emergency is not being imposed.
New information released by the Canadian government has confirmed the CIA played a role in the detention and rendition of Maher Arar. Arar is the Canadian citizen who was seized by U.S. officials during a stopover flight in New York in 2002. He was then secretly sent to Syria as part of the Bush administration's extraordinary rendition program. In Syria, Arar was held for almost a year in a grave-like cell. He was tortured. He was released without ever being charged with a crime. The newly released information was originally redacted from a major report issued by the Canadian government last year. It also reveals Canadian intelligence officials suspected the Bush administration would deport Arar to a country where he could be tortured. In October 2002, one Canadian official stated in a memo, quote, "I think the U.S. would like to get Arar to Jordan where they can have their way with him." New information has also revealed Arar was wrongly implicated based on information obtained through torture. Meanwhile, President Bush was questioned Thursday about the CIA and its secret overseas prisons known as black sites.
Reports that the Red Cross has found that the interrogation program in the CIA detention facilities used interrogation techniques that were tantamount to torture. I'm wondering if you have read that report and what your reaction to it is.
I haven't seen it. We don't torture.
According to Jane Mayer of the New Yorker magazine, only a handful of officials in the Bush administration have seen the report. Sources told Mayer the Red Cross also concluded that the U.S. officials responsible for the abusive treatment may have committed grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions and may have violated the U.S. Torture Act. Democratic presidential candidate Senator Joe Biden has suggested criminal charges could someday be filed against members of the Bush administration. In a recent interview with Newsweek, Biden said there are alternatives to the impeachment of President Bush. Biden said, quote, "I think we should be acquiring and accumulating all the data that's appropriate for possibly bringing criminal charges against members of this administration at a later date." Impeachment has been making headlines recently in the city of Kent, Ohio. Last month, local police ticketed a teacher named Kevin Eagler for posting a sign in the public garden that read, "Impeach Bush." Police ticketed him for unlawfully advertising in a public place. Eagler said that when he was stopped, he asked the police officer how his sign differed from realtors posting signs on public property saying, "This way to the house for sale." He said the officer asked, "You don't know the difference?" But then the police never explained what the difference might be, he said. The Transportation Security Administration and JetBlue Airways have been sued in federal court for illegally discriminating against an American resident based solely on the Arabic message on his T-shirt and his ethnicity. Last year, the Iraqi-born architect and blogger Raed Jarar was prohibited from boarding a flight in New York until he agreed to cover his T-shirt. Jarar first spoke about the incident on Democracy Now! Last year.
Then I was supposed to take my airplane, my JetBlue airplane, from JFK to Oakland in California last Saturday. So I went to the airport in the morning, and I was prevented to go to my airplane by four officers because I was wearing this T-shirt that says, "We will not be silent," in both Arabic and English. And I was told by one of the officials that wearing a T-shirt with Arabic script in an airport now is like going to a bank with a T-shirt that reads, "I am a robber."
The American Civil Liberties Union and the New York Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit against the TSA and JetBlue. China has deported six members of the group Students for a Free Tibet after they hung a banner on the Great Wall that read, quote, One World, One Dream, Free Tibet, 2008. The group included three Americans, Leslie Kaup of St. Paul, Minnesota, Nupur Modi of Oakland, California, and Duane Martinez of Sausalito, California. Earlier this week, Amnesty International criticized China for failing to improve its human rights record ahead of next year's Olympics in Beijing. In Massachusetts, the state's high court has ruled a pair of teenagers who allegedly plotted a Columbine-style attack on their high school could be charged under a state anti-terrorism law passed in the wake of September 11th. The former students are on trial for conspiracy to commit murder and threatening to use deadly weapons at school. The students were also originally charged with promotion of anarchy, but a judge tossed that charge after concluding the alleged conspirators were not trying to rally others in an attempt to overthrow the government. The rock band Pearl Jam has accused AT&T of censorship after the company removed comments the band made about President Bush during a recent concert that AT&T aired in an online webcast. During the concert, the band's singer, Eddie Vedder, said, George Bush, leave this world alone, and George Bush, find yourself another home. For viewers watching the concert via AT&T, the remarks were edited out. The group wrote on its website, quote, AT&T's actions strike at the heart of the public's concerns over the power that corporations have when it comes to determining what the public sees and hears through communications media. Media activists say AT&T's actions are a sign of why net neutrality is vital to keep the Internet open. Tim Carr of the Save the Internet campaign said, quote, AT&T acts in bad faith toward the public interest and will do whatever it can to pad its bottom line, including sacrificing its users' freedom to choose where they go, what they watch, and whom they listen to online. AT&T said the editing was not intentional and was a mistake by an outside vendor. And peace activists are planning a last-minute rally in Kennebunkport, Maine, on Saturday, where President Bush will be meeting with newly elected French President Nicolas Sarkozy. Sarkozy has been vacationing in nearby New Hampshire. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow announced the meeting on Wednesday.
We'll talk about some international matters, but this is not a summit. This is not something with an agenda. The agenda is come by and let's visit. And the main reason you're at Walker's Point is the First Lady extended the invitation and the French president's in the neighborhood.
Peace activists in Maine have accused the Bush administration of waiting until this week to announce the meeting in an effort to prevent large protests outside. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. The crisis of media consolidation continues. The FCC, chaired by Republican Kevin Martin, has not yet seen a merger that it doesn't like. Conglomerates like Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation are among the most powerful corporations on the planet. His papers routinely beat the drums for war while simultaneously distracting the public with gossip and glitz. Yet people are finding innovative ways to fight back, to demand independent, community-based media. One such effort that you can join is the movement to create new full-power, non-commercial FM radio stations in the United States.
This October, the Federal Communications Commission will open a one-week window during which nonprofit community groups in the United States can file applications for their own non-commercial broadcast license. A coalition called Radio for People has formed to help groups through the application process. It's a once-in-a-generation opportunity. Today, we're joined in our Firehouse studio by two members of that coalition. Ursula Rudenberg is with Pacifica Radio, and Libby Reinisch is with the Prometheus Radio Project. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Ursula, let's begin with you. Explain the significance of this window in October.
This is really about the need for local progressive media. Community activists know that it's almost impossible to get media coverage for the social issues that they want to bring to the public attention. I'm from the Midwest. Originally, I'm from Iowa. And in order to get public exposure for their issues, I know that my colleagues back in Iowa are having to resort these days to letters to the editor and to yard signs for getting the attention they need to their issues. So this is, you know, even today with exciting new media like the internet, radio still remains the most accessible and the most effective way for people in communities to communicate their issues. So this is about claiming what is really the right of us as American citizens to have access to the airwaves and to make them our media so that we can communicate what we need to each other as community members.
Libby Reinisch, given the explosion of obviously commercial media in the country, isn't the creation of a radio station like this to be able to, first to get the license, but then to create the station, prohibitively expensive? Or how can community organizations and nonprofits get involved?
Sure. It's definitely not prohibitively expensive to apply for these licenses. If you were to buy a non-commercial radio station in most places in the country, it would cost you millions of dollars. The FCC is handing out these licenses for free. The only associated costs are hiring an engineer and a lawyer to fill out your application for you, and then, of course, the cost of building the station, which can run you between $20,000 and $200,000, depending on the size of the station.
And how will the process work for the FCC to actually choose from applicants? Is there any kind of a vetting or point system that the FCC will be using for the applicants?
Yes, there's a new point system that the FCC is using for one of the first times this October, and it's much better than the system that they had before. It does favor local groups, and it favors groups that don't already own a radio station in a given market. So for groups that are facing competition from other applicants, they'll go through that point system, and it will be to their advantage to be at least a two-year-old organization that's headquartered in the community of license of the radio station.
Ursula, how do people find out if there is an FM signal? Now, a few weeks ago, we talked to Prometheus about the low-power signals and about people getting low-power radio. Also, explain the difference.
Okay. This is an important point because many people confuse the two, and they think that we're talking about low-power stations. This is about the full-power radio stations. A full-power station is a station that has 100 watts or more, which means that it can cover large areas. We have some stations that can cover, you know, the central part of a state. So this is
so it can be 100,000 watts, 50,000 watts.
Yes, yes.
So that means that will this be able to be done anywhere? For instance, let's take a group in Brooklyn, New York, like Make the Road by Walking. Will they be able to make an application, or will this be limited to particular areas of the country?
It's mostly not available in the big cities. If you live in one of the 10 biggest cities in the country, there's absolutely nothing available because the non-commercial dial is already full of radio stations. But if you live in any other city in the country, a medium-sized city, a smaller city, and especially in rural areas, there's a high likelihood that there's some frequency available for you.
Yeah, one thing that we should make clear is we're talking about non-commercial radio stations. The left side of the radio dial is reserved specifically for non-commercial stations. So we're not talking about most of the dial where you hear commercial radio. This is the left side, so there's a limited number of frequencies available, and these have been available for, you know, almost 50 years now. So they're, most of them have been taken in the urban areas.
And given the existing lack of diversity in the current radio system, are there any particular incentives or in the point system that the FCC is using for minorities and women to be able to apply for organizations to apply for these licenses?
No.
None whatsoever.
None whatsoever, no.
So right now, what are you suggesting people do to find out if there is a full power FM station in their area? And what does it mean? I mean, we're talking a window in the middle of October, the 12th to what, the 17th and 19th. That's when they apply. But what do they have to do first, like engineering studies?
Okay. The work actually happens prior to the window opening because it's a relatively complicated and lengthy process to be prepared. The way you apply for the license is you open up an account on the FCC's website. And you will be putting the information onto the website during the, and you will be registering this information during this window of the licensing, or the filing window. However, prior to that, what you're going to have to do is to make sure that your organization's legal standing and legal papers are in order so that it will undergo scrutiny successfully. This needs to be a nonprofit organization. You're going to need to work with a radio consulting engineer to make sure that you have a radio tower and to make sure all the technical details of your frequency will be worked out so that when it's entered into the website, that's correct.
I can already hear a lot of people clicking off right now saying, wow, I have a great nonprofit. It's been going on for a number of years. I don't know what you're talking about. I couldn't do an engineering study. Yeah. I don't have a tower. Yes. So how do people, let me, Libby, ask you, how do people get this if they're just a great group and that believe in grassroots communications?
Yeah, don't be intimidated by the complicated nature of this process. That's what groups like Pacifica and Prometheus and Common Frequency and the rest of the Radio for People Coalition are here for. We are here to help community groups sort through the application and fill it out properly so that they can get their own community radio station. All it takes is the desire, the inspiration, and the willingness to act quickly, because this opportunity is coming up fast. 2 months is not long to get through the engineering work and the legal work that needs to happen.
And those who want to get more information on how they can get involved or go through the application process, who do they contact?
They can contact Pacifica, they can contact Prometheus. There's two great websites they can go to get started. One of them is radioforpeople.org. The other is getradio.org. Getradio.org has a great zip code tool where you can plug in your zip code and it will give you an idea of whether or not there might be a frequency available in your town. You can also call Prometheus. The number is 215-727-9620 or Pacifica.
Yeah, you can call Pacifica at 510-812-7989.
Well, we'll put all that information on our website. Once in a generation opportunity for community groups in this country to get full power FM stations. We don't know if it will be happening again. I want to thank you both for being with us. Ursula Rudenberg is with Pacifica, the Pacifica Affiliates Coordinator, also Get Radio.
Getradio.org and radioforpeople.org.
And radioforpeople.org. And Libby Reinisch, full power coordinator for the Prometheus Radio Project. Thank you so much for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, no precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported.
Michael, my dear, come stay with my daughter.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. Apathetic, send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted.
We come and listen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, and that was Michael Franti, listener supported. In fact, Michael Franti will be holding a huge event, as he does every year, around September 11th, this September 8th, in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, called Power to the Peaceful. Well, Democracy Now! Airs on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community stations, on public access TV stations and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish to all radio stations in audio form and transcript form at our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Avi Lewis is the host of a new international news analysis show on a mainstream Canadian television channel, CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. This unapologetically politically progressive daily show was called On the Map. Avi is also an author and a documentary filmmaker. Earlier this summer, he, along with award-winning journalist Naomi Klein, co-wrote the foreword to a new book on the inside story of Argentina's remarkable movement to create worker-run factories.
Sin Patron, Stories from Argentina's Worker-Run Factories, was published by Haymarket Books in June. The book was compiled by La Vaca, an Argentine editorial and activist collective. 3 years ago, Avi and Naomi had worked together to produce The Take, a documentary about the workers in Argentina's reclaimed spaces. Avi Lewis now joins us in our Firehouse studio to talk about corporate media, to talk about independent media, to talk about doing independent documentaries, and also talk about this late breaking news around Maher Arar that we read in headlines, which is the story of this Canadian citizen, and you can tell us the rest, who came to our country, the United States, JFK Airport, and was sent off to Syria by U.S. authorities.
This news is astonishing, and when you've done great coverage here on Democracy Now! Of Maher Arar's case, and it gripped Canada for months and months on end as this commission went forward and tried to get to the bottom of what happened. Of course, he was completely exonerated. He was given an apology and a settlement, the biggest settlement we've ever seen for any case like this.
It was something like $10 million?
12.5 in Canadian terms at that time, but let's not get confused with the exchange rate. It was over $10 million. When they released the commission report, there were 1,500 words that were blacked out, that the government said, national security, we can't let the public see these words. And yesterday, the black was removed from most of those words. And what we know now is that it was what we always suspected. It was absolutely a case of CIA rendition. There was a rented Gulfstream jet and everything. Canadian authorities knew within 2 days of Maher Arar's rendition that he was likely to be tortured in Syria. This is really some of the smoking gun material in terms of the integration and harmonization of Canadian and U.S. security approaches after 9/11. But there's another part of the story that is not going to be told in the mainstream coverage. And it's part of a broader context of integration, which has been happening since 9/11 in the NAFTA countries. There's something called the Security and Prosperity Partnership. And in 10 days, the leaders of the three NAFTA countries will be gathering in 10 days in Montebello, Quebec, to meet at the latest summit around integration. The SPP has been called NAFTA on steroids. It's a deep integration project that reaches into every aspect of policy, health and immigration, and food safety. It's about access to the tar sands in Alberta, this massive and dirty source of energy. And it's happening without any public debate like NAFTA. It's happening without any legislation, all at the level of regulation and bureaucratic harmonization. 2 weeks.
Well, in other words, what you're saying is that there won't this won't be another treaty that will have to be approved by the various parliaments or
elected
bodies of the governments?
Precisely, and it's actually been designed that way, and various declassified documents from the SPP meetings over the last couple of years have specifically said that the time is not right for another big public debate, and this should be done by stealth. The connection between the SPP and Maher Arar is a really deep one. 2 weeks after 9/11, the head of the business lobby in Canada, a guy named Tom DeQuino, called immediately for deep harmonization and integration of U.S. and Canadian policies in order to keep the border open and the trade flowing. 2 months later, without any debate or without any legislative debate or really public involvement, they announced this Smart Border Initiative for harmonizing the border. And, well, you know, it was a piece of spin, the Smart Border Initiative. 9 months later, they announced that they had synchronized and harmonized Canada and the U.S.'s approach to passenger screening of international passengers. And 1 year after 9/11, based on that precise harmonization, Maher Arar was taken and subjected to extraordinary rendition and began his year-long odyssey in hell in a Syrian prison. So the connection between this mobilization that's going on in 10 days in Quebec around the SPP and the situation of Maher Arar is one that won't be made broadly in Canadian or U.S. media, but for people who care about sovereignty of nations and civil liberties, it's at the heart of it all.
But I'd like to get back to whether they can legally do this, given the fact that by your description of it, this would require all kinds of federal agencies at all levels with these governments to implement new rules of procedure. They'd have to have a rulemaking process, at least, that would bring it into the public sphere.
Well, these discussions aren't public, so we don't actually know what that's the problem. Fundamentally, we don't know what rule changes are being proposed or even being made, but they're specifically being made at the level of regulation and not at legislation, so that they can be altered by the government without, you know, disclosure of the kind that you get when you have a full public debate around legislation.
Avi, this program that you're doing, we just did this piece on high power, on full power FM stations and the importance of community media. We've been talking a lot about Rupert Murdoch as he takes over the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones Corporation. Can you talk about media consolidation in Canada and your own media moguls?
Well, most people don't know. I mean, I think there's a tendency in the United States and progressive communities to have a little bit of Canada envy. And I don't think around issues like healthcare, I think some of it is justified. In terms of media consolidation, Canada actually has a more consolidated media environment than the United States. And this is a largely untold story. But there have been huge mergers just in the last year and a half in Canada, and over the past 10 years, tremendous consolidation. One of the big waves of it took place in the late 90s with a man named Conrad Black at the helm. Now, you folks probably know of Conrad Black because he had a somewhat publicized fraud trial in Chicago. He was convicted on multiple counts of fraud for $3.5 million of defrauding his company. But Conrad Black in Canada is our sort of Rupert Murdoch. And I think it's something that Americans don't really know. It was treated to the extent that it was covered as one of these celebrity corporate scandals. Conrad Black in 1998 launched a newspaper called the National Post in Canada with the explicit and stated intention of changing the political landscape of Canada. At that time, Canada had two right-wing parties, and there was he really championed the campaign with this national newspaper in an unapologetic political ideological way to unite the right in Canada. And 10 years later, we have a conservative government in Canada because they managed to unite these two right-wing parties. And the shift in the media landscape had a very direct role in that. So Conrad Black is not just a convicted fraudster, as he's been reported in the United States. He really is one of the architects of the neoconservative success in Canada.
And did that trial have any effect on him?
On him,
on that power and media control.
Well,
he
sold that paper a couple of years later to some other media moguls in Canada that are even more right wing on some issues. And I don't think that. I mean, I think it has to do with. We need to make the connection between the ideological interests of media barons and how they play out in our public discourse. If these, in the same way that Enron needed to be seen as a policy and political phenomenon and not just a scandal. If we see them as just corruption trials, then all of a sudden they don't have political consequences. So we have to make those connections.
And what's been the impact of media consolidation on the public space in media? Obviously, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation still exists. I don't know to what level it is still a major force in Canada.
It's a major force in Canada. And things like the way that we cover elections on public broadcasting in Canada, things like the way we cover things like the Arar Commission, there is an independent space within public media. Now, it's subject to huge pressures, and there are huge pressures to privatize the CBC, and there always have been. We're constantly being told at the CBC that we're a hotbed of leftists by the right-wing corporate media. In fact, the CBC is a bastion of classic journalism of the old school. very rigorous news environment. But the CBC recognizes that as a public broadcaster, it needs to represent a broad spectrum of views. So they'll give a show to a person like me, whose politics are well known in Canada, and I'm allowed to do point of view journalism, where the point of view isn't hidden or you know, there's no subterfuge where when a guest starts making a point that I don't agree with, all of a sudden I go to a commercial because, you know, the hosts are resort to passive-aggressive techniques when they can't just put their views on the table. And the CBC has right-wing hosts on some shows and some radio shows and commentators on the national news. So it's a real spectrum that we have.
So what's on the map?
On the Map is a show that I did in June. CBC.ca/onthemap has an archive where all the shows that we did in June, a daily international news analysis show, they're all archived there. We're going to launch it again in early 2008. And it was an attempt to cover stories that are off the map. A lot of what we do is inspired by what you guys do and have been doing for many years. And to try to cover some of the critical stories of the day that for various reasons, political and otherwise, just don't get the attention they deserve.
To get back to the issue of the CBC, for our American audience who's not familiar with the Canadian system, how is the CBC funded? Is it subject to the same kind of political pressures, for instance, from the right-wing forces that the PBS is in this country?
Well, first of all, I should clarify that I work at CBC News World, which is our all-news network. It's the premier all-news network in Canada. It really is our CNN for the mainstream audience. It is not publicly funded. It survives on cable revenue. So cable subscribers pay and cable operators pass on the revenues for CBC News World. It operates completely independently of the public purse. But CBC radio and television, the main networks, the terrestrial channels, are publicly funded. There's intense independence from government interference. But there are perennial debates about, how much the government is subtly sending messages to the CBC. And what the real story is over the past 15 years, a slow starvation by cuts and cutbacks, which is increasing the arguments of those who are in favor of privatization, hobbling the CBC in its ability to cover the world the way that it always has and do programs that are real hits.
You've just come out with a book on Argentine worker struggles, and that's a companion to the documentary that you and your wife, Naomi Klein, did in Argentina. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the significance of this today?
So delighted to talk about this book. I don't know. We didn't really organize a product shot, but it's called Sin Patron. This is a book that was, I just wrote the foreword with my partner, Naomi Klein. It's a book written by the Lavaca Collective. The Lavaca, about Argentina's extraordinary movement of recovered companies. In the economic crisis that melted down Argentina in 2001, which many of your viewers and listeners will remember, out of that uprising, as Argentina threw out presidents had a massive upheaval of hundreds and thousands of people in the street, new social movements were born. And one of them were these workers who recovered their bankrupt companies. Companies that were pushed out of business by our own, so their versions of Conrad Black and Rupert Murdoch and other corporate fraudsters. Actually, Murdoch hasn't been convicted of anything. I should really take that back. Who heavily indebted companies, drove them out of business, took the money and ran when the crisis hit. And these workers were left literally in the most industrialized country in Latin America and the strongest middle class in Latin America. All of a sudden, they were left in a wasteland of abandoned factories. And so what workers started to do was simply get together, form cooperatives, and put their factories back into operation. It's an extraordinary movement, and 6 years later, 7 years later for some of these companies, they're still flourishing. They have, in some cases, complete workplace democracy. Decisions are made in assemblies. And the workers all have a single vote. They make all of their struggle decisions, their political decisions, their production decisions democratically. And they have proved that this is the managerial class in a lot of industrial settings is a huge burden on businesses. The perks and the chauffeurs and the trips and the consultants were weighing these companies down. And workers are running them very successfully, very democratically, and in solidarity with each other. This book is an extraordinary work because it is the definitive work on this inspiring new movement, which has really gripped the imagination of activists around the world in the past few years. And the collective Lavaca that wrote it are a worker cooperative inspired by the people that whose stories they tell. The book is the bulk of the book is in the words of the workers themselves.
And what has happened to that workers' cooperative movement once a more sympathetic or progressive government, Kirchner, came to power? What's been the fate of that movement continuing to thrive or develop?
You know, in truth, the Kirchner government has not helped this movement in the slightest, and it appears to be almost entirely unaware of it. The movement has thrived without any real assistance from anything in the state in Argentina. And in fact, the threats continue. I mean, just this week, the Bowen Hotel, an extraordinarily symbolic place because it was opened in 1978 by the military, under the military dictatorship, with a huge state loan from the dictatorship to a friendly businessman, a loan that was never paid back. A debt that finally crippled the business. The workers took it over in 2001. It has become a meeting place for the movement in the center of Buenos Aires. And they've been fighting eviction attempts for years. They started with 40 or so employees and an empty building, and they now have 150 employees and a beautiful, flourishing hotel, which is also a meeting space, which is also a space of political action. And this week, they're facing another eviction threat from a hostile city government. The Zenon factory, the biggest ceramic tile factory in all of Latin America, which has some 450 employees. Now they make something like 500,000 square meters of tile a month, are now facing another eviction threat, despite the fact that they had a court give them a three-year mandate to run the company as a cooperative. The former owner from Italy is launching a separate attempt to get back the business that he drove under. So the movement still has to fight for every little gain that it makes, but it is flourishing.
Before you leave, Avi, we have to ask you about Canadian health care. I'm going to play a clip of Michael Moore's Sicko because it has put it certainly on the map here in the United States.
We got an issue in America. Too many good docs are getting out of business. Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
When Michael Moore decided to make a movie on the healthcare industry, top-level executives were on the defensive. What were they hiding?
That's not on, right?
No.
Okay.
The intent is to maximize profits.
You denied more people healthcare, you got a bonus.
When you don't spend money on somebody, it's a savings to the company.
I want America to have the finest healthcare in the world.
Four healthcare lobbyists for every member of Congress. Here's what it costs to buy these men and this woman, this guy, and this guy. And the United States slipped to 37 in healthcare around the world, just slightly ahead of Slovenia.
I denied a man a necessary operation and thus caused his death. This secured my reputation and it ensured my continued advancement in the healthcare field.
In the world's richest country.
I work three jobs.
You work three jobs?
Yes.
Uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that is fantastic.
Laughter isn't the best medicine.
I get a bill from my insurance company telling me that the ambulance ride wasn't pre-approved. I don't know when I was supposed to pre-approve it. After I gained consciousness in the car, before I got in the ambulance.
It's the only medicine.
There was actually one place on American soil that had free, universal health care.
Which way to Guantanamo Bay?
Detainees representing a threat to our national security are given access to top-notch medical facilities.
Permission to enter. I have three 9/11 rescue workers.
They just want some medical attention.
Michael Moore's Sicko.
That a trailer of Michael Moore's Sicko. It has put Canadian healthcare on the map here. Industry is fighting back. What do you mean? You want to stand on those long lines, Avi?
Yeah, well, you know, we do have some long wait times in the Canadian healthcare system.
So do we.
Yeah, I think you guys do, too. You know, the people who complain about waiting times are rarely the people who have had surgeries. There's a sub-industry in Canada, too, of finding those people who have been waiting 2 years for a hip or whatever else. Look, the truth is that I think that Michael Moore unduly romanticizes Canada. We have a complicated, problematic healthcare system like every country in the world. We don't have a fully public healthcare system. There's a huge amount of private insurance and private delivery of services in the Canadian market, healthcare market, which is increasingly referred to as a market. But fundamentally, we have universal coverage And it's you don't have to be rich to get sick. It's a system which is it really is at the heart of our national identity in Canada, and we argue about it constantly. But the fact is, just a quick personal story. I had a huge accident when I was about 20 years old. I took a bad fall. My tibia was split in two pieces. My ankle was shattered. I had major reconstructive surgery, 3 plates, 24 screws, skin grafts, bone grafts. I was a month in hospital. And when we left the hospital, they gave me a bill for $79 for a pair of crutches that wasn't covered by public insurance. That is also the Canadian healthcare system. But you have to say that, like any public service, people of privilege, people with white skin, people of a certain socioeconomic class have an advantage because you have to work the system in order to get the best care. And so definitely healthcare and its quality is racialized, and it's a matter of class and gender as well. But fundamentally, we have a belief in our society that we pay, 35-45% in personal income taxes, and we are taken care of when we fall out.
And in terms of the impact not only on the individual citizen, but on companies and corporations as well, I think one of the things that's created the increasing debate in the United States is that major corporations now are facing huge problems in being able to pay for the health care insurance of their own employees. What's been the impact in terms of companies in Canada to have this kind of health care system that's basically government paid, subsidized?
One of the biggest drivers of the Canadian economy is the auto industry on the Detroit-Windsor border. And for many, many years, there were two things that kept it going. One was the Auto Pact, which said if America wants to sell a car in Canada, they have to build one there. That was made illegal by NAFTA, and so we don't have those basic trade protections and agreements anymore. But the other thing was that the Canadian healthcare system is a huge subsidy to industries. And along with a low dollar and some of those other policies that we had, Canadian healthcare was seen as, made Canada a great place to invest, which is why... There's also huge money at stake, and big healthcare corporations are looking at Canada's market and just going like, we got to get in.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but you can report back to us on how that all pans
out. We're fighting this privatization of healthcare thing in Canada.
Avi Lewis, host of the new CBC program On the Map, also co-wrote the preface to the new book Sin Patron: Stories from Argentina's Worker-Run Factories. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. Marcel Khalife, The Scream, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
This week marks the 62nd anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. On Monday, tens of thousands of mourners gathered in Hiroshima to remember the day. At 8:15 a.m., bells rang throughout the city to mark the moment, the time when the U.S. B-29 air warplane, Enola Gray, dropped the bomb. Residents throughout Hiroshima observed a minute's silence in memory of those who perished. An estimated 140,000 people were killed instantly or died within a few months of the bombing on August 6, 1945. 3 days later, another U.S. warplane dropped a plutonium bomb on the city of Nagasaki, killing about 80,000 people.
On Thursday at 11.02 a.m., two high school students tolled the bell to mark the precise moment the bomb was dropped on the city.
Yesterday, we spoke with a survivor of the Hiroshima bombing. Yuri Nakamura was a teenager when the attack took place. She was 13. We asked her to describe that day 62 years ago.
8月6日は本当に暑い日で、朝から真っ青な空で太陽がギラギラ照りつける日でした。
On August 6, 1945, it was a very hot day and with a burning summer sun.
朝からアメリカの飛行機が飛んできて、空襲警報、警戒警報が鳴り響いていました。
From the early morning, we saw and we heard lots of air attacking warning and also lots of American airplanes.
私は工場の中にいましたけれど、友人が外に出て、あ、B29 が来たよ。落下傘のようなものを落としたと言った瞬間、バーッとすごい光がそこら中を照らしました。
もう少し上に行ってください。Yes, I was inside of the factory, but my friend called from outside saying, look, there is a planes, airplanes, it might be a B-29. And right after she shouted, that then yellow-orange colored light flashed like a bolt of lightning.
バーッと光が光った瞬間、私は広島の中心部の方をパッと見ました。その瞬間、すっごい風圧で爆風がバーッと飛んできて、ガラス、木のかけら、土壁、いろんなものが吹き飛んできて、私は跳ね飛ばされました。
As soon as, or at the moment, we saw the big lightning, I feel like that big blast is coming, and that blast is contaminated with grass and dirt and blew through the inside of our factory, and I was knocked down to the floor.
体中にガラスが刺さって、私は鼻血は出る。手からも腕からもいろんなところに刺さった傷でそこから血が噴き出しました。
All the little pieces of the glasses is stuck in my body. It's all over my body, the whole entire body. And it's got my uniform got red and stained with blood. And I had a blood nose and bleeding all over my body.
今までに本当に空襲がなかったので、私はその工場に直接爆弾が落ちたとばっかり思って、もうまたここにいるとまた落ちて私は死ぬのではないかと思って、とにかくここを逃げ出そう、そういう一心で倒れた工場の中からようやく外に這い出すことができました。
I never actually experienced direct bomb hit.So I thought that was it. No, and the factory I was in has been hit by a bomb. So I thought I should get out of the factory as soon as possible. And I did. I barely made it. And I thought I would die soon.
それはまるで本当に悪魔が私たちを襲ってくるような感じがいたしました。
Yes, then I was told if anything's happened, go to a, evacuate to a dugout behind my, behind the town. And I went there and I saw the blue sky all of a sudden turn into a big, huge cloud. Looks like a mushroom cloud. And I thought what big devil is covered the sky.
Yuko Nakamura, a survivor of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima. Throughout this August, the commemoration of the 62nd anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombings of Japan, groups across the country have been working to expose the escalating threat of nuclear weapons. We also spoke with Bal Pingal, who's been accompanying Yuko. He's the coordinator of the American Friends Service Committee, described some of the actions that have been taking place this month.
So we had a forum August 6th, the 62nd anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing, at the American Friends Service Committee, where Mrs. Nakamura shared her experience as a 13-year-old survivor of the Hiroshima bombing. We also had her available for local events. For instance, she spoke with a group of organizers who had a civil disobedience event in front of the Lockheed Martin facility in King of Prussia, just outside Philadelphia. And that was August 6th. On August 7th, we went to Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania, where she participated also in an action in front of the Carnegie Mellon University, which, especially in front of the Software Engineering Institute, which is actually doing a lot of software connected with nuclear weapons and nuclear arms. And the vigil was attended by probably around the constant audience was around 20 people, but a lot of people were stopping by to listen to the kind of sharing that Mrs. Nakamura was giving. So, and now we are here in Florence, Massachusetts, actually, to have another event for the 62nd anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki.
And what is that event, Bob Pingel?
Well, we will have a forum, and several organizations in the area are participating. But then in the evening, and in conjunction with a Japanese tradition to commemorate the dead, we will be floating candles, actually, in a pond. And there will be peace messages in those lanterns. And Mrs. Nakamura will also be speaking in front of crowd who will be assembled for that event.
What about the significance of this week and Japanese policy now around the military, around militarism, the controversy with the prime minister having to apologize for suggesting that he might have thought the bombing was appropriate?
We have heard about what happened actually in Japan, where while the people were applauding the mayor of Hiroshima, who is, of course, the leading advocate of the mayors for peace, that the prime minister was not getting the same attention from the people. It only goes to show the kind of sentiment that the Japanese people have, in particular in relation to what the prime minister wants to happen regarding Article 9. I think Japan...
What is Article 9?
Article 9 is basically provision in the Japanese constitution that renounces war as an instrument of national policy, that basically demilitarizes Japan, no standing army and things like that. And it also implies the non-existence of industries that are manufacturing weapons. But this will go against the corporate interests of so many corporations, both Japanese as well as Americans.
And Bal Pingel is with the American Friends Service Committee, engaged in actions protesting corporations involved with nuclear weapons. We end today, though, in Nagasaki. 62 years ago yesterday, the U.S. dropped the second atomic bomb on Nagasaki. We turn to Anthony Weller. His father, George Weller, is the journalist who provided the firsthand account of conditions in post-nuclear Nagasaki for the Chicago Daily News, or tried to. We only have a minute left in this broadcast, but Anthony Weller, can you tell us what happened, how your father got into Nagasaki, how he wrote his report, and why we didn't read it?
Sure. He was present at the signing of the Treaty of Surrender in Tokyo Bay on the 2nd of September, where he and all the other correspondents were told that southern Japan, including the two nuclear sites, was off limits. And at that point in the war, he was absolutely fed up with MacArthur's relentless censorship of reporters throughout the Pacific theater, and he determined to make his way down there no matter how he could, and he managed to hitch a ride on a military plane to the very southern tip of Kyushu and then broke away from his handlers and sneaked by boat and train up to Nagasaki and presented himself as a U.S. colonel to the Japanese major general in charge and said he'd been sent to gather information.
Anthony, we have just 10 seconds. If you could explain what happened with the remarkable report that he wrote.
Well, they were utterly censored. 3 weeks of his reporting was censored by MacArthur's men, never saw the light of day until I found them all after his death in his house, and they've now been published by Crown.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. First into Nagasaki is the name of that book. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.